welcome to the Rufus Project, your fortnightly guide to geek, game, movie, and local entertainment news. In this episode, we're pretty excited. You see, Christian and I are both involved in a little group known as Cards for Sorrow, who perform regular interactive screenings of the infamous Rocky Horror Picture Show. Since we have a screening coming up pretty soon, we thought that this episode could certainly have a Rocky Horror flavour. I've dug deep in the internet archives and actually found a game to review that's related to the Rocky Horror movie. Christian is also doing a bit of a retrospective of Rocky Horror for us, and as a special treat, Christian will be joining me in this week's redeeming features, which again, is kind of linked to Rocky Horror. Beyond that, we also have an interview with one of the cast members of Cards for Sorrow, and don't worry, it's not Christian and me interviewing ourselves, as well as details of the upcoming screening and your chance to win free tickets. It's not all Rocky Horror, though. I'm also going to review the new X-Men movie, and of course we're going to have all our regular geek news. So keep on listening, and I hope you enjoy this very special Rocky Horror-themed episode of The Rufus Project. It's a rather special night. Before we move on to the Rocky Horror shenanigans, well, we still need to have a look at the news, don't we? So what has been grabbing our attention over the past fortnight? First up, we have two rather interesting anniversaries. Within the past 2 weeks, we saw both the 34th birthday of Pac-Man and the 35th anniversary of the original Alien movie. And in all that time, no one ever thought to do a crossover. Seems like a wasted opportunity, really. The BBC launched a trailer confirming the return of Doctor Who this August, with new star Peter Capaldi. I'll put the trailer over in the bonus features on YouTube, but I can tell you what, don't blink. Don't even blink. Because if you do, you're going to miss seeing Peter Capaldi. After reporting last time that The Australian ran a story saying that Netflix could well be launching in Australia within the next 12 months, well, Netflix came back and said, no, we're not. The Australian really needs to stop running that story. I think it's about the third time they've done it now. It's getting beyond the joke, guys. In related news, the Google Chromecast has now officially launched in Australia, and it didn't even make it to midday on launch day before the first guides started to appear on how to access Netflix through the device. As an aside, I've managed to get my hands on one of the little beauties and am currently testing it out. So be sure to listen next episode for a bit of a rundown of what the Chromecast can do. And of course, being the Australian geek news, guess what? There's been more anti-piracy shenanigans. The CEO of Australian animation production company Animalogic, who had a hand in Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs and the Lego Movie, has come out and said that he would like to see anti-piracy classes run in primary schools, probably around grade 5. Personally, I'd prefer to keep commercial interests out of our classrooms, but hey, call me crazy for thinking that. And finally, the Australian Attorney General George Brandis isn't going to let us forget that he's going to introduce new anti-piracy laws. Now don't worry, I'm not going to go into another rant, but if you do want to know more about his proposals, go back a couple of episodes and... yeah, well, I'll warn you, I'd get a bit heated in that discussion. But to follow up on that, he's now come out saying that Australians are the worst pirates in the world. I mean, you only have to look at the proliferation of black market stalls selling pirated copies of new release movies all over Australia, just like they are in places like Thailand and Singapore. But really, I do think it's a bit rough to label Australians as the worst pirates in the world. I think, given the rather appalling treatment of Australians by the entertainment industry, we've gotten pretty damn good at piracy. Since this episode is having a bit of a Rocky flavour, I thought it only fitting that we do something a bit different with the computer game review section. I jumped into a time machine. Okay, I really found a copy of a disk image and downloaded a Commodore 64 emulator. And I took a trip back to 1985 and played the Rocky Horror computer game. It did exist. So So how closely did this multimedia powerhouse mirror the movie that shared its name? In the game, you can choose to play as Brad or Janet. Once inside the castle, you need to find keys to unlock doors, as well as find pieces of the D-Medusa machine, so you can unfreeze the character you didn't choose, and you can both escape the castle. To complicate matters, you have characters like Frank, Magenta, and Rocky wandering around, who, if you connect with them, will spout a line of dialogue from the Time Warp or other parts of the movie. And they'll probably also steal your clothes and hide them. This adds a bit of extra complications to the game, since you need to get your clothes back before you can keep finding the items that you need. You need to watch out for Riffraff though, as he has a laser gun which will kill you instantly, and there is a temperature gauge on the side of the screen telling you the freezer temperature. If the temperature gets too high, then Eddie will thaw out and come after you on his motorcycle, and he's pretty hard to avoid. And when it comes to the gameplay, that's about it. Graphic-wise, it's about what you'd expect from a Commodore 64 game from the mid-80s. When you start the game, you are greeted to quite a nice interpretation of looking at the castle from the gates, complete with enter at your own risk sign and bolts of lightning. But once inside, you've got your typical blocky sprites wandering around, but hey, at least you can tell which character is which. Gameplay-wise, you move from room to room, looking for either a key or a part of the D-Medusa machine. However, you can only carry one of each of these at any one time, which means there is a lot of to-ing and fro-ing between the castle's dozen or so rooms. It won't take very long before you've seen every room in the place, and then it's just a matter of going around in circles to get what you need, bit by bit. Your only real obstacles are the other characters, and they move very erratically and randomly. There is no discernible pattern, which does get very annoying very quickly when your clothes have been stolen for the fifth time, or the fact that Riff Raff suddenly changes direction, shot you, and then game over, closing credits. Most of the rooms are recognisable from the movie, except for one strange one that you teleport into occasionally, which provides a nice shortcut, but it's just a white room full of floating random objects. I have no idea what the context is. I don't think I want to know what the context is. It's just strange. Sound effect wise, well, you do get some nice lightning effects at the very, very start. But once you're in the game proper, there is just a loop of the Time Warp. Now, aficionados of the Commodore 64 musical scene will know that that machine was actually capable of some pretty impressive audio. There are a number of sites you can go to listen to some of the best stuff this machine had to offer. I can pretty much guarantee you will not be hearing the version of the Time Warp from this game. It is a buzzy, cheesy loop of a much shortened version of the song. And if you have the stamina to play this game all the way through, you're going to be listening to the same cheesy loop and nothing else for a good 15 to 20 minutes. I lasted about 3 minutes before I turned the sound off. Essentially, the Rocky Horror computer game is a pretty standard 80s exploration and hunt game. You find the pieces you need to advance, avoid the wandering obstacles, reach some arbitrary goal, and then it's game over. For the Rocky Horror Game Over screen, you're presented with another view of the initial castle scene before the closing credits roll. It is, however, pretty poor, even by the mid-80s standard exploration game of this flavour. If your passion means that you must experience all things Rocky, then this game is pretty easy to find with a quick Google search. Considering the age of this game, and the fact that it's not for sale anywhere anymore, and in fact completely out of print, there are pretty much zero issues with you downloading it. The Rocky Horror Computer Game? Enter at your own risk.
I would like, if I may, to take you on a strange journey.
The Rocky Horror Show started life as an experimental musical play in London's Royal Court Theatre in 1973. Writer Richard O'Brien brought some songs to director Jim Sharman with a loose plot and some of the narrator's dialogue. The rest of the show grew out of rehearsals. Originally to play for 6 weeks, the show ended up running for 10 years, playing at a variety of London venues in the process. In 1974, the year following its first release, entrepreneur Lou Adler took the show to Los Angeles and opened it at the infamous Roxy Theatre on the Sunset Strip. It became the hottest ticket in town. People like Elvis, John Lennon would turn up to the productions, and eventually 20th Century Fox decided to make it into a movie.
Master, Master, we have a visitor.
They chose to make it for $1 million and use people from the original stage production. Released as the Rocky Horror Picture Show in September 1975, the initial release of the film was a box office bomb. 20th Century Fox didn't know what to do with this movie musical about a transvestite alien who invites a young engaged couple into his castle for the unleashing of his muscle man. The following year, Fox's publicity team opened the movie at midnight, and the rest is history. Audiences came once, twice, three times, up to 50 times to see the movie. People started dressing up, bringing along props, and yelling out lines in time with the movie. Soon casts formed, which would reenact the film on the stage in front of the screen the whole way through the movie. Over 40 years later, it's hard to deny the impact of the Rocky Horror Picture Show, the ultimate cult movie.
I see you shiver with anticipation.
My history with Rocky Horror is quite interesting. I first encountered the film back when I was being babysat when I was 9 years old. Completely went over my head and didn't understand any of it. However, I always planned to see the movie again when I was a bit more aware and could understand a bit more of what I was seeing. I borrowed the video out when I was 16 in grade 11 and took it home and was still a bit unsure about what to make of this movie. I didn't quite see the obsession. I didn't see the reason for the fandom. So I returned the video to the video shop, never to think about it again. However, people started making references to Rocky Horror in conversations. A friend of mine had the video, and I remember going over one day and saying, "Can I please borrow this for a couple of months?" And I borrowed it, saw it a few more times, and then one day it just hit me, oh my god, I'm obsessed with this movie. I think it took quite a few months for her to get that video back out of my hands. The rest, as I like to say, is history.
Are we destined to destroy each other? Or can we change who we are and unite? Is the future truly set?
X-Men Days of Future Past sees everyone's favourite mutated superpowered humans facing a bit of a problem. In the future, a program known as the Sentinel Program has been so good at tracking them down, they're pretty much almost gone. In a last-ditch effort, Professor Charles Xavier, played by Patrick Stewart and James McAvoy, and Magneto, played by Ian McKellen and Michael Fassbender, have to send Wolverine, played by Hugh Jackman, back into his younger body to stop Mystique, played by Jennifer Lawrence, from killing Dr. Bolivar Trask, played by Peter Dinklage. You see, he's the guy who made the Sentinels, and it was his murder that led to their ultimate creation. So can Wolverine save the day and change the future? Well, I'm not going to do any spoilers, so you'll just have to see the movie to find out for yourself. So, should you see this movie? I think when talking about superhero movies, it's going to be a lot easier if we refer to them as either BA or PA, before Avengers or post-Avengers. You see, if X-Men Days of Future Past had come out BA, then I would happily say that it's probably one of the best superhero movies I've ever seen. However, we all live PA, don't we? And the whole connectedness of the Avenger movie universe has really shown us how good and how well done these sort of movies can be. So this means I will have to, I guess, downgrade my opinion of this movie slightly. At its core, this movie really is mainly about Wolverine and Charles Xavier. And a lot of the movie does rest on the interaction between Hugh Jackman and James McAvoy as these two iconic characters. Hugh Jackman as Wolverine is truly Hugh Jackman as Wolverine.
You and I are going to be good friends. You just don't know it yet.
It's probably one of the more iconic roles that he has played in his career, and he plays it, obviously, with great pleasure. James McAvoy has a few more issues as young Charles Xavier.
Could you give me that one more time, please?
Stay with me.
He gets to start it as a bit of a mopey version of the character, and you do find yourself wishing that Wolverine would just, you know, punch him in the nose or something to try to bring him to his senses a bit quicker. The other main players in the movie, Michael Fassbender as Eric Lenzer, better known as Magneto.
Charles. Good to see you too, old friend.
And Jennifer Lawrence as the mysterious Mystique.
Well, don't hold back.
Occasionally seem to be trying a bit too hard to keep the serious gravitas of their characters going. I guess to make up for this, they are probably both involved in the more spectacular action sequences within the movie, but their overall performance during the run-of-the-mill talky bits in the middle doesn't really add much to the film. Of course, being an X-Men movie, there are a plethora of other mutants around, displaying all sorts of spectacular powers, many of which really are very, very impressive. But with the focus being on, I suppose, the central four characters, they're only really there for either providing some pyrotechnics or helping with a bit of exposition. The standout of the supporting cast, though, has to go to Evan Peters as Quicksilver.
Prison Break? That's illegal, you know.
Only if you get caught.
He gets to play a rather major part in a particularly pivotal part of the movie, and he really does it perfectly. It's such a shame that we saw so little of this guy in this film. We can only hope that now, since every movie is only made, if it can at least be a trilogy, we'll get to see a bit more of him in the next X-Men movie. In the non-human ranks, Peter Dinklage as Dr. Bolivar Trask is really the only pure human that we get to spend much time with.
There is a new enemy out there. You'll need a new weapon for this war.
However, his performance pretty much comes down to serious concern, and, well, you can just say it's perfectly workable for what he's trying to portray. Pacing-wise, there are plenty of big action sequences, and the compulsory talky bits and exposition bits in the middle don't drag on too long and manage to keep you engaged with the movie. Since the main focus of the movie is set back in time in the 70s, they have a bit of fun with the people and the places of the time, including a brief sequence set in the heart of the Vietnam War, but most of it really could have been happening anywhere and anywhen. But at the end of the day, most of these quibbles, well, they really are minor quibbles. There is no denying that X-Men Days of Future Past is a very enjoyable experience, with plenty of spectacular action to keep you on your toes, and none of the intervening bits are dragging out too long to let boredom set in. It would have been nice if some of the minor characters could have got a bit more screen time or a bit more exposure, especially Evan Peters as Quicksilver. Seriously, when you get to his big scene, it is the highlight of the movie, even better than the rather spectacular section with Magneto towards the end. The acting performances may not be the best or the strongest, but they're still perfectly serviceable, and again, don't detract from the enjoyment of the film. Like I said earlier, if this movie had come out before the Avengers saga, then I probably would be giving it a much better review. X-Men Days of Future Past, though, is still well worth your time.
It's going to take all of us to end this war.
Boy? Oh, boy.
Hello, I'm Dr. Cosmo McKinley. I'd like to tell you about a new film from the gang that gave you the Rocky Horror Show. Shock Treatment.
So as I mentioned earlier, our redeeming features on this episode relates to Rocky Horror in a way. We're actually looking at the unofficial sequel, Shock Treatment. Now, I'm not really the expert on this movie, so I thought I'd throw to someone who knows a bit more about it than I do. So, Christian, could you perhaps give us a little bit of a rundown on Shock Treatment?
Okay, thank you, Trevor. I don't know if it's a good thing to be saying I'm a bit of an expert on this subject, but I'm happy to show some facts where possible. Now, in the wake of Rocky Horror Picture Show coming out in 1975 and the cult following surrounding that, Richard O'Brien and the team that created the stage show and the movie decided, wow, we're going to do a sequel. Originally to be Revenge of the Old Queen, then became The Brad and Janet Show, and then an actor's strike led it to become Shock Treatment, a movie that was released as a musical in 1981. To this day, it is one that Richard O'Brien is quite embarrassed about, but however, it does feature a lot of the Aussies in the cast and crew that appeared in the original film. In 2014, it's interesting to look back at this movie, and it's as much as it's easy to diss this movie, it's hard to deny that it's a part of the Rocky Horror history, so it's very important that we talk about it.
Okay, well, I think that's enough about the facts of the movie. What we really want to see is if there are any redeeming features that might get people to watch it now. So, Christian, where would you start?
Well, I've got a couple, or three, to be honest. But my first thing would be probably the most obvious one that people say when you do ask them what their redeeming feature about the movie is, and it is the soundtrack. Not written as a stage show like the Rocky Horror Show was, which became the movie. Richard O'Brien was really, you know, writing a score essentially for a movie medium, so, and it very much sounds very 80s. And it's interesting, one of the songs, Looking for Trade, was a reject from the Rocky Horror Picture Show, which was going to be called Looking for Blood, which was then replaced with Superheroes. And the song Little Black Dress sounds very familiar to Time Warp. Aside from that, a lot of the songs are very very trademark Richard O'Brien, but at the same time very unique and very separate from Rocky Horror. And I think possibly in many ways it has a stronger score than the Rocky Horror Picture Show. Gasp.
Yeah, well, you can't deny those songs are damn catchy. You need a bit of...
Oh, definitely. They'll have you humming for hours. I remember even actually forking out the $30 to buy the soundtrack back in the late 90s because I was so keen to get a copy of these, you know, to hear on regular rotation. And I think I haven't been able to get them out of my head ever since.
Well, interestingly, as I discovered the other day, the soundtrack is on Spotify, which really surprised me.
I think I actually discovered it there recently and, yeah, was quite surprised by it too. But then when it's got the Grease 2 soundtrack, I thought, But Shock Treatment does kind of go to that level of even more obscurity. And I think it's sometimes, it's really funny, it's so obscure even to the Rocky Horror fans, which is the cult it's essentially playing to. But even then, it so isolates Rocky Horror fans that it's screaming to find its own audience. I think that's really the secret to Shock Treatment. I kind of feel a bit sorry for it. It's got this innocence about it. It was trying so hard. And I was thinking about it, you know, there's lots of references to the original, you know, the Rocky Horror Picture Show. There's props and costumes seen in the background and things like that. But ironically, they tried to duplicate Rocky Horror, but it became in many ways the most unlike Rocky Horror that they could ever find. That it, you know, it was a cult classic, I think, before it came out.
And I did notice a very familiar face in there with Barry Humphries joining the cast. I don't know if he counts as a redeeming feature because, frankly, I found his performance in this movie awful. But, hey, he's still an Aussie icon.
Oh, definitely. And you have to add something aside from Barry McKenzie to his filmography. So.
Good stuff. Anything else that you noticed in the movie?
And probably another one that I thought was the strong lead female, which is Jessica Harper. Now, I'm a big fan of her. She's a cult movie icon to me. She was, you know, famous in 70s horror movie Suspiria and in a very lesser-known Brian De Palma film called Phantom of the Paradise. But some of our listeners out there may know of Jessica Harper as the lead actress of that movie. Now, interestingly, Phantom of the Paradise was often billed with Rocky Horror Picture Show when it first came out. So I think it was interesting that they chose Jessica Harper as the lead because it kind of was a connection, like a missing link between Rocky Horror and Shock Treatment. And I think she does the job really well. Obviously, you know, she's no Susan Sarandon, and to compare them is really quite, you know, stupid. I think the best thing is to see them as two totally different Janets. I actually interviewed Jessica Harper a couple of years ago about, you know, about her career, but I managed just to slide some Shock Treatment questions in there. And while she was, you know, hoping that the film would turn out to be a success and was disappointed when it wasn't, she was quite stoked when a couple of years after it came out, she was greeted one day at the door by a group of people on Halloween dressed as all the characters from Shock Treatment. And that's when she started to realise, okay, there is some kind of interest around this film. And I think, yeah, definitely she's one of the strong points.
Very good. Probably after talking about Janet, we should talk about her Brad, Clifty Young, playing both Brad Majors and Farley Flavors. I really think that his performance as Brad was probably one of the better performers in the movie, mainly because he spent most of the time gagged and tied to a chair.
And it's really, well, it's interesting because, yeah, and then when he does play Farley Flavors, he's really playing him as this manic guy with lots of twitching and all this sort of stuff kept happening. They say he was trying to channel Jack Nicholson with the role, but originally Tim Curry was offered the part of Farley Flavors but felt that he couldn't pull off the American accent, and I think he really would have been quite wasted in the role, to be honest. And Clifty Young, as you said, just bumbles his way through it, but in most other movies I see him in, he pretty much does that in everything.
I was actually quite disturbed by some of the facial expressions he was pulling whilst watching Janet on the screens. It's like, is he, like, having a moment or something? It was just,
Yeah, lucky they didn't have Farley Flavors at Brad and Janet's wedding. Let's just say that could have got a bit awkward.
indeed. Mind you, the bit where Brad and Farley confront each other, and very cleverly you never see both of them on the screen at the same time in the entire confrontation scene, just before that song starts, it gets very Dr. Seuss.
Yeah, it's interesting. Even if that particular part too is on the soundtrack, so you can always hear that before the song, Jewel Duet, which is the song. And yeah, it is very much like that. But they say a lot of that was, like I was mentioning before about the certain phrasing that Richard O'Brien used, they say that was a reflection of how his writing style. I can't think of it offhand. I should be able to recite this off by heart. But, you know, one of those, you know, you're a loser, and who are you, sir? You know, your twin brother and your seducer. You know, so it used a lot of, yeah, a lot of Seussism, I suppose.
So what else would you say would be probably one of the more defining features of Shock Treatment?
Well, definitely its look, and I think, as I mentioned with the actor strike that happened earlier, the reason they had a lot of budget cuts and had to, you know, make Shock Treatment, which was this show that was set in a studio. They had so many budget restraints, and I think it meant they could be very much more creative. And in many ways, the film was a preempted reality television. I can't really think of anything that dates back to that, where people were getting engaged with it. The whole Big Brother, everyone watching this, you know, Janet's mum and dad living on a TV game show, you know, in TV. And I think that was definitely a very clever thing, but it would have come out of something that was totally unplanned. It was more that, you know, it just happened to preempt Big Brother over 20 years. So
indeed.
I think it was definitely something that happened very smartly, but they wouldn't have been aware of doing it, much like Rocky Horror. They weren't expecting them to make what they did, and look what happened.
Well, I think they certainly got the painful annoyances of reality TV down pat. There are some terrible sequences you've got. I mean, sorry, there's some stuff in there that I just can't get over. Some of the ads and just, yeah. But I see,
yeah.
The way that the entire audience gets let out of the studio to head off to the new show towards the end, it's like reality TV equals Pied Piper for humans, which is a pretty fair statement.
Which all ends with them, you know. Oh, we don't want to ruin too much of an ending, but there are straitjackets involved. But I think to me that the corker is the part where they all, the end of that song Lullaby, which is when Janet and all the staff of Denton Vale are all, you know, going to sleep, and then there's a shot of the audience all cuddled up together with pillows and blankets, like literally they live there. And it really is quite, it's easy to laugh and go how ridiculous, but it's kind of come true in a way. You know, obviously we're not at the point where we're sleeping over at studios, but you know, we're becoming quite obsessed with things, and it's, yeah, it showed Denton as, I suppose, a microcosm of that. It's very deep, isn't it? I don't think they intended the film to be that deep.
No, I think any depth and any major statements on the world were purely accidental.
It all begins and ends with Barry Humphries.
It should never have started with Barry Humphries.
So, yeah, so I'd be interested to see what our listeners will think about whether, you know, the theory, it's not a sequel, it's not a prequel, it's an equal. Is that true? Or should Richard O'Brien be embarrassed by it? Or should he be proud of it and celebrating it every year?
Yeah, well, if we have convinced anyone out there to watch Shock Treatment, definitely let us know what you thought. And let us know what you thought of us, if we managed to convince you to watch this as well. Okay, well, thanks, Christian. That was fantastic.
No worries. I look forward to hearing from our post-Shock Treatment viewers. Or the straitjackets.
Excellent. Thank you.
Thank you.
You'll be pathetically crazy about Shock Treatment. Trust me. I'm a doctor.
Before we move on to this episode's fantastic interview, I thought I'd get Christian to give us a little bit of a rundown on Cards for Sorrow. Interview follows straight after.
In September 2000, I took my love of the Rocky Horror Picture Show to the next level. I'd always thought in high school how awesome would it be to start one of these floor show casts. You know the groups I mean, the ones that reenact the whole movie in front of the screen whilst it plays. I started Cards for Sorrow in September 2000, and we're a reenactment group who bring the movie to life at screenings around Brisbane. Over 13 years later, and the cast is still going strong. We've been seen at venues such as Chanel Theatre, Tribal Theatre, Globe Theatre, and even been on Channel 10's Weather and the News. It's hard to deny the impact of the film all these years later. Having run Carts for Sorrow since the beginning, I've seen all the different people come through and the different generations and the different walks of life that are attracted to this movie. It's really hard to believe that a movie that started as this very small experimental theatre production would go on to impact so many people's lives. It's impacted mine in a way that I could never imagine.
Well, here we are in the lovely Lock and Load Bistro at West End. You may have heard Christian mentioning it a few times. And I have the great pleasure of welcoming our next guest to the Rufus Project. You may have seen her as Calliope Kink doing a few burlesque shows. But tonight we're going to talk more about her role with regards to Cards for Sorrow and the Rocky Horror performance cast. So, Melinda, welcome to the Rufus Project.
Thank you for having me.
Well, first up, why don't you tell us a bit about yourself and how you first discovered Rocky Horror?
Okay, I guess I've always been a little bit of a theatre geek, I guess. I was into drama in high school and that kind of thing, and I've always liked to dress up in costumes. So when my cousin told me about this phenomenon of people dressing up and participating in a movie for Rocky Horror, my mind was blown a little bit. And it had just so happened a couple of weeks after we'd been talking about it, I happened to see an advertisement in the Chanel cinema when I was at uni, basically saying that there was this thing called Cards for Sorrow and they were going to act out Rocky Horror and audience participation and all of that. So I thought, oh, well, let's go along. We had 2 days' notice, and of course, being the people that we were, decided to go in full costume, so madly got to task buying all the bits and pieces to make an authentic magenta-made costume and an authentic sequined outfit for Columbia, which have just really evolved from there. And so, yeah, that's kind of how I got involved and started going along to all of the shows because I fell in love straight away and started talking to the cast, and here I am now.
Fantastic. So really, what were your first impressions when you watched that first show?
It was, I did watch the movie before we went along to the show, just to kind of prepare myself. I'd seen bits of it before, but I hadn't seen it all in one sitting. And so I had been warned, and I did kind of come out of it thinking, what have I just signed myself up for? This is a bit ridiculous. But the idea of dressing up and being the avid researcher that I am, looking up all of the AP and all of the lines that you can shout out, and knowing the words of the songs from my mum playing them when I was a child, I thought I'll just get into the atmosphere, and I'm glad I did, because the first night there was an absolute ball, and I've never really looked back.
Fantastic. And I'm pretty sure you were, because I do remember, like, from previous performances, looking out, thinking, people like, they've got better costumes than we do.
Yeah, that was me.
That was you.
That was actually the way I got to meet Christian, as he came up to me after one show and said, you have better costumes than we do, please join. So I did.
Fantastic. So what do you think is just this appeal of people getting up there and lip-syncing to the movie and getting dressed up and the audience yelling out these lines?
I think it's a combination of things. First of all, I think that people really like to get involved in stuff. So sitting back and watching a movie is nice, but we all, when we're in the privacy of our own home, start shouting at the screen or, you know, warning the characters or singing along or whatever. So when we can do that on the massive scale in a whole theatre full of people in costume, that's a really appealing kind of a thing. And I think also just the cult status of Rocky Horror itself. I mean, it's come from people thinking it was tacky and weird at the very beginning and continuing that on and just making it more tacky and weird, which is really, I think, what appeals to most people who come along.
It's a logical progression, really.
Yeah.
Okay. What would be your favourite AP line? What has you wanted to crack up on stage?
There are a couple that I am glad that I'm usually magenta or Columbia and I have a mask on, and so I can kind of crack a bit of a smile, and I can't think of any of those right now. They'll come back to me. But my all-time favourite, and I happen to be off stage when this one happens, and so I often actually do call it out myself, is at the end of the movie when Brad and Janet are asked to leave the castle and you shout out, "Does that mean we can't use your phone?"
Yes.
My absolute favourite. I think I heard that the second time I went along to the show, and ever since then, that's my favourite.
It's right up there with Tupperware.
Tupperware is also a good one, yes.
What would you say has been your most memorable moment on stage?
Oh, my most memorable moment. There are many. There have been the times when I've played Columbia extra authentically, nips, lips and all, which has been fun. There is the time that our backdrop fell over on us and the movie stopped partway through and we kept going. Mm-hmm. And I think one of my all-time favourites is my sister Marlena is actually in the cast some of the times as well, and often we'll play back-to-back with Magenta and Columbia, and there is a certain scene where Magenta and Columbia get a little bit friendly with one another, and that was particularly enjoyable when our grandparents were in the audience in the front row, really, really taking it in.
Another horrified look. That we have backstage when that happens, so yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so as mentioned before, you often introduce, well, you're from the first person people see as Trixie, doing the opening song, and you play Magenta, you play Columbia. So who is your favourite character in the movie, and who would be your favourite one to play?
My favourite character in the movie, and I had to think hard about this because I do pretty much love them all, but I really think my favourite character is Riff Raff. He's just got some kind... He's so emotional. He really, obviously, with Richard O'Brien being the creator of the story, he really owns it and he owns his character. And I really feel for Riff at the end when a little tear runs down his cheek. And so, yeah, I think I really like Riff.
I like to think that he's actually the hero of the movie.
Yeah. In terms of playing, I've played most characters. There was actually a time that at the last minute I had to jump on stage as a Riff in tiny hot pants and a wig, so that was fun.
Well, I have played Magenta before, so...
Yeah, exactly. You've got to share it around. And I really can't choose my favourite. I love the fact that I can be Magenta and I can be Columbia, and I love the fact that I can work both of those in with Trixie. So, yeah.
Now, as we mentioned before, you're also known as Calliope Kink. And,
that's right.
And I often see the events with Calliope Kink and the Shimmy Shakers.
Yes.
So, just curious, we all know Rocky's happening on June 20.
Yes. Friday, June the 20th.
Friday, June the 20th. Write it down, guys. So, everyone will obviously be happy to see you then, but where else can they see you? What do you have coming up?
Well, Calliope's kind of been a little bit quiet lately, and the Shimmy Shakers have been a little bit busy with a few other academic things going on, but we do try and get out there and perform whenever we can. Actually, 2 days after the Rocky Horror Show is Lady Marlene's School of Arts recital, so it's our performance afternoon for the end of term. So you'll see Calliope there in a few different class routines. She'll be doing a veil routine with Bertie Page, and she'll be doing a boylesque drag king routine, which is quite suggestively about trying to fit your car in a tight space. And you'll also see her debuting a brand new vocal solo, which is probably of interest to some of the listeners here, because it's one of my favourite bands is called Ludo from America. Not many people in Australia have heard of them. They've got some great hits like Love Me Dead and Broken Bride, and I'm actually singing one of their songs called Battle Cry, but I'm doing it in the character of Princess Peach singing to Mario after he's killed, to kind of, you know, gee him up and get him to keep going and catch that flag. So, yeah, that's another thing I'll be introducing on that night. Other than that, we have a Grease floor show coming up, and I've...
They know a little bit about that.
I think I'm allowed to announce that I'm going to be one of the Pink Ladies, and so are some of the Shimmy Shakers, so that's going to be a great time for us to get back together and get back out there.
Great. Thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us, and certainly looking forward to seeing you at Rocky on the 20th of June. and Greece and anywhere else anywhere we can else. Catch up you That's catch right. up with you as Trixie or Calliope or
or any of my Magenta other many identities that I take. Yeah.
And for those who do know the true identity, just saying hi to you in the street. Thanks so much for talking to the Rufus Project.
Thank you.
Late last month, we launched the new Globe Theatre Cinema program, and boy, have we got a big June for you. Not just the Globe Theatre stuff, but also the other screenings I'm doing around Brisbane. On Sunday the 8th, we have a big screen feature of the Rolling Stones, Rock and Roll Circus, and Ziggy Stardust and Spiders from Mars from 4 p.m. That's Sunday the 8th of June. On the 22nd of June, how about checking out the movie musical Chicago on the big screen at 6 p.m. The following Wednesday, the 25th of June, we're doing a special screening of Who Framed Roger Rabbit in memory of the late star Bob Hoskins. That is screening at 7 p.m. For all of these sessions, tickets are available at the door. In terms of the Chanel Theatre, we've got the Terminator 30th anniversary screening. We warned it would be back on the 17th of June. That's screening at 7 p.m. And that Friday, we also have the infamous Rocky Horror Picture Show screening, as you've heard us mention. If music's more your thing, how about joining the 80s vs 90s retro party on Friday the 27th of June? Take a side, are you team 80s or are you team 90s? And battle it out on the dance floor with over 4 hours of two decades of classic hits. That's at St Paul's Tavern at Spring Hill on Friday the 27th of June at 8 p.m. Tickets are available at the door for all of these events. And for more information, visit www.christianfletcher.com. We're looking forward to a very full winter in terms of events. I look forward to seeing you there. Yes, it's that time of the podcast again. It's ticket giveaway time. To follow on from our Rocky Horror theme, we thought it was only natural to give away a double pass to our next Rocky Horror Picture Show interactive screening. Coming up on Friday the 20th of June at 8 p.m. at the Chanel Theatre at UQ, see the Rocky Horror Picture Show in a way that you've never seen it before, brought to life by 15 colourful performers who bring the film to life as an interactive floor show. If you've never experienced the movie like this, this is the only way it should be experienced. For details about entering the competition, head to the Rufus Project on Facebook or Twitter. And for more information about the upcoming screening, visit austix.com.au where you can purchase your tickets for this fabulous and outrageous night. We look forward to doing the time warp again.
Now, where would the Rufus Project be if we weren't trying to give you stuff? Our competitions this time are all about the movie tickets. We still have that double pass for the 30th anniversary screening of Terminator at the Chanel Cinema at St. Lucia. And to win that, all you need to do is comment Terminator. And also don't forget to put a comment in there saying Rocky to get those tickets that Christian mentioned for the Cards for Sorrow Rocky Horror screening on June 20 at the same cinema. Now remember, you can comment on our Twitter page, our Facebook page, the Podomatic page, the YouTube comments, and I'm sure there's some way you can do it on iTunes as well. Good luck! Thanks for listening to The Rufus Project. We hope you enjoyed listening to this episode as much as we did putting it together. If you have any feedback, suggestions, or just want to say hello, please leave a comment for us on our Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, Podomatic page, or you can even review us on iTunes. Also, don't forget that if you have an upcoming event that you would like us to talk about, or even just mention, drop us a line as well. We're also interested in hearing from all kinds of people who might like to want to have a feature in our local wildlife section. Hey look, so far we've had a male burlesque champion, comic book writers from the US, the very awesome Christian Fletcher, a real life Ghostbuster, a dedicated charity fundraiser, and of course our great chat with the very talented Melinda on this very episode. So if you know of someone you'd love to hear from in our local wildlife section, or if you yourself would like to be part of it, then let us know. So until next time, I can't think of a witty sign out, so feel free to add your own. See you next time. really astounds me how many stupid or misinformed stories are run by what is meant to be Australia's most prestigious newspaper. I almost bought back the Clever Geek of the Week just for them.